Copyright notice. The contents of this podcast, including intro music, are copyright Phantom Femme. The podcast artwork is copyright Isabeau of WAGProductions.org. This labyrinth, the Phantom of the Opera, in Eric's times, and ours. Hello, and welcome, finally, to episode 7 of In This Labyrinth. Thanks, as always, to everyone who's tuned in and or who's tuned back in. And huge apologies for the long hiatus. Yikes. I know I said I would try to have this episode out in early October, and I really apologize that that didn't happen. As I mentioned before, I've had a really hugely busy September and October with family and school. But one of the issues I deal with is chronic low energy and, in fact, often outright fatigue. And so, during a really busy period like that, it's often very hard for me to find energy to record. But, again, I really apologize for the delay. That being said, though, I've got what I hope will be a really interesting and enjoyable episode here for you all. So, if folks don't mind, let's leap right into it. So, for this episode, I want to talk about obsession, because it's a very strong theme in Phantom. It's a very strong theme within the story itself, obviously. There are debates to this day, as some listeners will know, within the fan community as to whether the Phantom really sincerely loved Christine all along, or whether that didn't come until he learned to let her go at the end, and before that he was just quote-unquote obsessed with her. But even if you read it as I do, as that his love for her was true and real from the beginning, it still has a strong obsessive quality or character or tone to it. And that, of course, comes out of how wounded the Phantom is, psychically, psychologically, and spiritually, because of the way society has treated him. He needs her, and that need runs very deep. So yeah, obsession, obsessive passion, obsessive need, obsessive love is a very strong theme in the story itself. But it's also something many of us fans experience with regard to Phantom. I, myself, proudly and defiantly identify as an obsessed fan. Because, A, although there have been times in my life when I've been obsessed with other things for a period, I've always kept coming back to Phantom. And B, although there are times when it sort of banks down to embers and is more in the background, my love for Phantom, my obsession with Phantom, always catches fire again. And when it does, it is all-consuming. And I know I'm not the only fan out there who experiences Phantom that way. I know I'm not the only fan out there who experiences Phantom as an all, or at least a significantly or most consuming passion and obsession. And so for this episode, I want to kind of explore the way that the Phantom fan community has reclaimed the idea and the experience of that kind of obsession, kind of very much in the same way that the LGBT community has reclaimed that experience and reclaimed words like dyke and queer and gay. Because when you think about it, in our culture, in our society, obsession slash obsessed are words that have a lot of very negative connotations, a lot of very negative meanings attached to them. Like, if you look them up in the dictionary, the definitions given are at best ambivalent and most often very negative. So, for example, if you go to the Merriam-Webster dictionary online, the definitions it gives are, one, a persistent, disturbing preoccupation with an often unreasonable thought or idea, broadly, compelling motivation, unquote. And the examples it gives are an obsession with profits, i.e. with making money, or an obsession with gambling. And then the second definition it gives is, quote, something that causes an obsession, unquote. And the example it gives is how losing weight can be an obsession that leads to the avoidance of certain foods. So as you can hear, that's a very negative definition. Then the Oxford Dictionary online says, quote, the state of being obsessed with someone or something, quote, and it gives as the example, quote, she cared for him with a devotion bordering on obsession, unquote. And notice the way that's gendered? And then as its second definition, the Oxford gives, quote, an idea or thought that continually preoccupies or intrudes on a person's mind, unquote. And as the example sentence for that, it gives, quote, he was in the grip of an obsession he was powerless to resist, unquote. So, although that doesn't hit the negatives as hard as the Webster's definition, it's still pretty negative. Dictionary.com gives a slightly more neutral definition. Quote, one, the domination of one's thoughts or feelings by a persistent idea, image, desire, etc. Two, the desire, image, feeling, etc. itself. Three, the state of being obsessed, unquote. So, those are Dictionary.com's definitions of the word obsession. And then it gives a whole host of examples of that word used in sentences, some contemporary, a lot from articles from the Daily Beast, and some historical from literature mostly. And while Dictionary.com's own definitions are, as you can hear, more neutral-ish, the example sentences range from the neutral down to the negative. And don't worry, I'll post a link to that and to all the definitions that I'm referring to here on the blog where I post the show notes on the podcast website. And then finally, UrbanDictionary.com gives a whole bunch of definitions for obsession. It gives about six or seven, some of which approach neutrality, but most of which are pretty damn negative. Most of the definitions and examples given center around ideas of being out of control, of being totally taken over and dominated by a thought or idea or activity, and of course around obsessive love and stalking. And yes, of course, I will post a link to that in the show notes blog too. So these are the understandings of obsession and being obsessed that dominate in society. And as you can hear, they're overwhelmingly very negative. The history, though, of first of all how we came to have a concept of obsession and of being obsessed, and then of how those concepts came to have such negative meanings and such negative connotations attached to them, is really interesting. And once again, I'm drawing on the work of disability scholar Leonard Davis. Listeners might remember I referenced his work back in episode 2 when I was talking about the LaRue novel and how it handles the issue of normalcy. But Davis has also written a really interesting book that I'll put the bibliographic information for in the show notes on the history of the development of the idea, the concept of obsession in Western thought and in Western medicine. And it does a really excellent job of looking at that history critically. It's really fascinating. So, according to Davis, the concept of obsession or of being obsessed comes to us originally from Roman warfare by way of medieval and Renaissance Christian demonology. So originally, back in Roman times, obsession or obsessio in Latin was a military term, a warfare term that meant to lay siege to a city that you were trying to conquer. And then in the medieval and Renaissance period, that idea gets adopted and incorporated into Christian church theories of spiritual warfare. So in medieval and Renaissance religious theory, if you were obsessed, if you were being obsessed by a demon, it meant that it was trying to possess you, but it hadn't succeeded yet. It meant that your soul, like a city, was under siege by a demon, but hadn't been fully conquered yet. It was still holding out, just like a city under military siege. But the road from there to our modern 20th century understanding of obsession as a purely psychological condition is kind of strange and convoluted. Because, according to Leonard Davis's research at least, in spite of what you might think, the concept of obsession and the term obsession, obsessed, etc., don't immediately get adopted from this medieval and Renaissance spiritual demonological framework straight into modern Western medicine. And in fact, the term obsession itself never does become, never has become, a formal medical diagnosis in and of itself. You'll never be diagnosed with obsession. At least as far as I can tell from the admittedly inexpert research I've done so far for this podcast episode. Instead, you'll be diagnosed with an obsessive disorder like OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, or obsessive personality disorder. So the adjective, or is it an adverb, obsessive, has gotten incorporated into the names of various medical conditions and the concept of obsession with it. But obsession itself has not become a formal medical term. And even that, even the incorporation of the adjective, adverb, whatever, obsessive, into the names of medical conditions, doesn't happen until the beginning of the 20th century. Before that, starting in the early 19th century, the terms monomania or idée fixe, which means fixed idea in French, are used. What's really interesting, though, and interestingly enough, Leonard Davis does not himself make this connection in his book, even though it takes till the 20th century for the word obsessive to make its way into medical terminology and only in its adjective or adverb, whatever form at that, the modern medicalized notions of these conditions, whether they're calling it idée fixe, monomania, or obsessive compulsive disorder, share the idea of being under siege by something unwanted with the medieval and Renaissance spiritual warfare ideas, except that in this case, instead of being obsessed or laid siege to by a demon that's trying to possess your soul, the person is obsessed or laid siege to by an unwanted thought or idea or feeling that they can't get rid of. And interestingly enough, that parallel isn't spelled out explicitly in anything that I've read so far, including Leonard Davis's book, but it is striking. The similarity is really striking. Though, of course, in the 19th and 20th and 21st centuries, of course, the presence of the tormenting or besieging thought slash idea slash feeling is explained biologically rather than spiritually. And for those folks who are interested, Leonard Davis does, in his book, go into some of the different theories that have been used over the past 200 years to explain those tormenting or besieging thoughts, ideas, etc., ranging from high-strung nerves in the 19th century to brain chemistry today. But Davis also really goes into how, throughout the 19th and much of the 20th centuries, quote, obsessive disorders, unquote, were really understood as part of the price of civilization and modernity and progress, because they were understood as diseases of overspecialization. Because with modern industrialization, people were having to specialize in ways that they never had before. And that was recognized. So in pre-modern societies, in the medieval and Renaissance, and even well into the 18th century, well into the 1700s, a person would do lots of different kinds of work throughout their life. I mean, there were some specialists like priests and doctors and craftspeople, but among most ordinary people, you do lots of different kinds of work as part of just accomplishing the daily tasks of rural life. And among the upper classes, the ideal was the quote-unquote Renaissance man, the person who was skilled in many things, art, music, poetry, writing, rather than specializing in just one thing. And in fact, in the pre-modern world, specializing too much was considered unhealthy. With the Industrial Revolution, though, you start to get hyper-specialization, and this really takes off in the 19th century, the 1800s. So now, if you're a common working person, instead of doing all the varied tasks that you do running a farm, say, you'd work in a factory, and you'd do literally the same task over and over again all day for years. Or, if you're a higher class, then you're a writer, or a painter, or a musician, or a lawyer, or a business person, or a politician, and you're that one profession for your whole life. You might have hobbies on the side, but that one thing becomes the focus of your life and your existence. And as Leonard Davis points out, there's a recognition, especially in the 19th and early 20th centuries, that this hyper-specialization is a very new thing, and there's an ambivalent relationship to it. On one hand, there's a recognition that it brings a great deal of industry and productivity and scientific discovery and new inventions and new technologies, but there's an uneasiness about it. There's a fear that this hyper-specialization could turn on a person and become unhealthy. And, as Leonard Davis points out, that becomes the basis behind some of the early, mid, and late 19th century medical theories of how to explain the, quote, obsessive disorders, unquote. But it also really takes off in the popular imagination. And that's where you get all kinds of literature and later film featuring artists or scientists or inventors whose work totally takes over their life to the point where it ultimately becomes a torment to them and ultimately destroys them. And, as Davis points out, that's where you also get lots of actual historical figures, artists and scientists, who seem to live that out, at least according to their medical case files, biographies, and autobiographies. And, interestingly enough, it's here, outside of formal medical diagnosis in popular culture, in media, and art, music, literature, film, etc., that the actual terms obsessed and obsession start to get used, although, again, not till into the 20th century. But obsessed and obsession become, you might say, the terms of popular diagnosis rather than formal medical diagnosis. And they become very bound up, as Leonard Davis points out, with cultural debates around where is the line between genius and madness, quote-unquote genius and quote-unquote madness, how much specialization is good, modern, progressive industriousness, and how much is unhealthy, basically around what is a healthy versus an unhealthy level of attachment to or absorption in anything. What I find really interesting and fascinating, though, is that this dominant idea, this dominant definition of obsession that's developed over the past 200-odd years of being tormented by an unwanted idea or feeling or impulse or whatever that you can't get rid of by normal means is not what Phantom fans mean by obsession. It's not the way Phantom fans experience obsession. At least, in my experience, it's not. Yes, we may experience Phantom as a driving need. Some fans might even be comfortable using the word compulsion to describe it. Thus why we do stuff like see the show as often as we can, listen to the soundtrack as much as we possibly can, collect all the Phantom stuff we can, etc. But generally, at least in my experience, fans don't experience that driving need slash compulsion for Phantom as a torment. Quite the opposite, in fact. We experience it as a joy, and some fans even as our deepest joy. So given that, as well as the history outlined earlier, as I said at the beginning, I find it most interesting that Phantom fans have chosen to reclaim this term obsession to describe our feelings about Phantom, to describe the way we experience Phantom. Now, part of that may be because there is the trope of obsessive love, or the idea, or the myth, the narrative of obsessive love out there. And of course, that's a trope that's very much present in the story of Phantom itself. And so I would suspect that many fans are re-slash-claiming that idea of obsession, especially fans who strongly identify with the Phantom. Because I would guess that the Phantom's obsessive love for Christine and for his music kind of gives us fans permission to claim that kind of obsessive love for Phantom. And that kind of fits with my experience, but I'd be very interested to hear what other fans think about that. I suspect, though, and as I said, this was certainly the case for me, that for many fans, there's a sense of a need to claim obsession or to claim being obsessed with Phantom as something of an act of defiance, because although obsessive love is romanticized in a lot of media and popular culture, many would say including Phantom, our culture also considers obsessive love unhealthy, considers it excessive. Furthermore, although we fans experience our obsession with Phantom as a joy rather than as any kind of torment, I don't know about other fans, though I would suspect that I'm not alone in this. I'd be interested to hear from other fans about this. I've had many experiences in which it was very clear that my excess of emotion, of passion with regard to Phantom, made normative society very uncomfortable. It really freaked out those who identify with normalcy. And again, and I'd be interested to hear if other fans have experienced this too, especially in the school system, the public education system. I did find the odd teacher who was supportive of my love for Phantom, my obsession with Phantom, but the vast majority of my teachers in public school and the residence counselors at the residential school for the blind that I went to for a bunch of years tried unsuccessfully to discourage the obsession. I would even go so far as to say to suppress it. And they tried to persuade my mom to discourage and suppress my obsession with Phantom too, which thankfully she didn't. Thankfully, she chose to listen to her parenting instincts instead of my teachers and residence counselors and was supportive of me. Indeed, she often stood up for my Phantom obsession and helped me stand up for my Phantom obsession to my teachers and residence counselors. And I know I'm very lucky and blessed in that. I know not everyone, not all fans, have been fortunate enough to have that kind of support. But what was really interesting in all this was to observe in what contexts quote-unquote excessive quote-unquote emotion was socially acceptable and in what contexts it was not. Because, for example, in high school, it was completely not socially acceptable. Nobody, at least that I ever saw or knew about, displayed that kind of quote-unquote excessive emotion or passion about anything because I think they all thought they were too cool for that. Whereas when I was at the School for the Blind, during what would have been equivalent basically to middle school, there were contexts in which it was acceptable to display that kind of emotion about certain things. So, for example, and here I totally date myself, in 1992, when the Blue Jays played the World Series, our baseball team here in Toronto played the World Series, a significant chunk of the student population was absolutely obsessed with baseball and with the World Series, and nobody thought anything of it. Similarly, back in grade 4 and grade 5, quite a few of my girl-identifying peers were absolutely obsessed with New Kids on the Block, and again, nobody thought anything of it. Those obsessions with sports and with bands like New Kids on the Block were considered perfectly normal. And what strikes me about that is that they were considered perfectly normal and therefore perfectly healthy for two reasons. A, they were considered age and gender appropriate. And B, they didn't last. They were short-lived. So, for example, the baseball obsession kind of fizzled out once the World Series ended. And the New Kids on the Block fans eventually moved on to other things, other bands, other celebrities, etc. Whereas with Phantom, although I think it was considered gender appropriate because at that time I very much presented as Christine, I was girl identified and I very much presented as Christine, and the times when I went as the Phantom were written off because it was Halloween, I don't think it was considered age appropriate. But also, of course, as alluded to there, there's the normative idea that as you grow up, as you grow out of sort of first puberty and into young adulthood and adulthood, you're supposed to grow out of that kind of obsession, that kind of passion, that kind of love, that kind of display of quote-unquote excessive emotion, and sort of settle down into a broad range of lukewarm interests. At least that's how it always came across to me. But of course, for many of us fans, it doesn't work that way. Now, yes, I have heard that there are ex-fans out there. But for many of us, once we become fans, we remain fans for, well, it's been 28 years for me now, and I know there are people who've been fans even longer. So the obsession for us tends to last long past the age when you're supposed to have, quote-unquote, grown out of that phase. And it's not that we don't have other interests and even other obsessions, in spite of what some people tend to think. It's just that those other interests and obsessions are either subordinate to Phantom, or the Phantom obsession just never goes away entirely, no matter what else we're interested in or doing. And, or, those other interests, hobbies, etc., are similar to or related to Phantom. Or the Phantom obsession is a thing that comes back periodically and, or, that sort of flares back into full force periodically. There's lots of different ways that long-term, long-time fans experience their obsession. But when that obsession is in full force, it involves an intensity of emotion that normative society says that healthy, well-adjusted, well-rounded adults aren't supposed to experience, aren't supposed to feel. Because in the modern Western ideal, adults, healthy, well-rounded, well-adjusted adults, are supposed to be in control. They're supposed to be in control of their bodies, of their minds, of their emotions, of their passions. They're not supposed to let, we're not supposed to let our bodies, minds, emotions, passions, etc., get control of us. And so to be obsessed, even if you experience, or even if one experiences it as a joy, is to fall short of that notion of adulthood as being in control. And so normative society defines our obsession as unhealthy, even when we fans don't ourselves experience it as a problem. We may experience society's attitude toward our obsession as a problem, but not the obsession itself. And of course, that ties back into the cultural debates that I referenced earlier that Leonard Davis talks about in his book that have raged throughout the 20th century over what was, is, should be considered a healthy level of emotional intensity, focus, specialization, etc., and what should be considered unhealthy. And it seems to me that, although it's not often explicitly stated this way, the dividing line that gets decided on culturally is whether you are or are seen to be in control of your focus, emotional intensity, specialization, etc., or whether it is in control of or is seen to be in control of you. But it also has a lot to do with productivity, quote-unquote productivity, with whether what you're focused on slash obsessed with is seen as a productive pursuit. So, for example, if your focus or obsession is science or math or medicine or law or something like that, it'll be rewarded because it's seen as leading straight to a productive career, to a nice, well-paying career, and you'll be supported and encouraged in it. Similarly, if you're obsessed with becoming a musician or a dancer or an actor, depending on your context, that may also be seen as productive, as leading to a productive career, and you'll be supported and encouraged in it. Though, in any of those cases, it also depends on whether those careers are seen as ones you are capable of attaining. If, however, your obsession is phantom, though I know lots of gamers and people in other fandoms have found this too, that is not seen as productive because the path from that to a well-paying job or career is not easily seen, is not easily perceived by your teachers, guidance counselors, etc. And so it's not seen as a productive pursuit. And certainly, I know that was the case with a lot of my teachers in middle school and especially high school. And of course, it doesn't necessarily lead straightforwardly and obviously to a well-paying, much less high-paying job or career. It's one of those cases where you just have to follow your heart, follow the obsession, and see where it leads. And in my case, of course, it's led to my doing this podcast, but also I have to say, to doing a significant amount of my graduate-level academic work actually on Phantom, which would have surprised and astonished my high school guidance counselor that you could actually do that. But this issue of productivity, as Leonard Davis discusses, goes all the way back to the 19th century in terms of its role, its place in the debate over where to draw the line between quote-unquote healthy, modern, industrious focus and specialization and quote-unquote unhealthy, quote-unquote hyperfixation. So then as now, if you became a doctor or a lawyer, preferably a famous one, or a famous artist or musician, or you got rich in business, then you'd be considered a model of modernity and productivity and industriousness, and your eccentricities would be excused. But if it didn't, if your obsession didn't lead there, then it would be considered a disorder. And given all that, now that I think about it, I think it's really interesting that it should be the Andrew Lloyd Webber original stage musical that, for so many of us, was the version of Phantom that sparked our obsession to life. Because, if you'll recall, I talked about way back in episode 3 that it's the Lloyd Webber stage musical that gives the strongest critique of normalcy and these kind of ideas about having to be in control and having to be productive that go along with it, of any version of Phantom that I've yet heard. And then the obsession that that version of Phantom sparks brings us into conflict with those very normalcy notions that it itself offers a critique of or offers a challenge to, or brings us further into conflict with them, because for many of us, we were already in conflict with normalcy, which was what made Phantom resonate with us in the first place. And furthermore, for me at least, and I'd love to know if other fans experienced this as well, being obsessed with Phantom became a way to resist both attempts to normalize me and, you might say, the rules of normalcy themselves. It became an inspiration for resistance and also gave me concrete ways and opportunities to defy those rules. Mostly by flagrantly displaying my quote-unquote unproductive obsession with Phantom in the face of teachers who thought I should get over it. Although I realized that a huge part of the reason I was able to do that was because I had such a supportive mom and such a supportive home environment, and I realize that not all fans have had that. Still, I think it's super interesting how obsession with Phantom can be a resistance to the very normalcy, the very normativity that Phantom itself, especially the original Lloyd Webber stage musical, critiques or challenges. And as I said at the beginning, it does feel like Phantom fans have kind of reclaimed the idea of obsession and the word obsession in very much the same way. It does feel sort of analogous to the way that words like queer and dyke and crip in the disabled community have been reclaimed. And that aspect of fanship, that aspect of fandom, is something I definitely want to explore more in future episodes of this podcast. So, I hope you've all enjoyed this discussion of Phantom fanship and obsession. I've certainly enjoyed researching and presenting it. And as always, I hope it's given folks lots to think about. And also, as always, I would love to hear your thoughts on this topic or on any other topic that I've covered so far in the show. And if you have ideas of topics or other things you'd like to hear me talk about, by all means, send them to me. Or if you would like to come on the show, let me know, because I would definitely love, I speak from my own experience and my own perspective, but of course, there's lots of other different perspectives out there, and I would love to talk to fans who are coming from different experiences and different perspectives than my own. Because there's a great diversity out there in the fan community, and I certainly can't claim to speak for or represent all of that by any stretch of the imagination. And B, I'd really love to showcase or amplify the voices of that diversity here on the show. Plus, I think it would just make it that much more interesting for listeners than just listening to me all the time. I certainly try to keep things lively and interesting, but more voices are always better. So yeah, if you want to get in touch with me, with the show, if you have a topic idea you'd like to suggest, or if you'd like to be on the show, or if you just want to send feedback and tell me what you think of this episode or any other, you can send an old-fashioned email to inthislabyrinth@yahoo.com, or you can tweet at the show at @ITLPodcast. And of course, you can also follow the show at @ITLPodcast on Twitter. There's also, of course, the Facebook page for the show that you can like and or follow. And of course, as I've mentioned before, there's a Facebook group for the show as well as the page, so that you listeners can share stuff and have discussions as well as just get updates from me. Sadly, I'm not in the Facebook group much because of time scarcity, but by all means, feel free to join the Facebook group and to share stuff and have discussions there, and I will try to pop in whenever I can. And both the page and the group have the name of this podcast, In This Labyrinth, The Phantom of the Opera in Eric's Times and Hours. So if you search In This Labyrinth on Facebook, you should be able to find them both. But also, there's a link to the Facebook page on the podcast website, which is at https://inthislabyrinth.fireside.fm. And There's also a link to the Facebook group on the Facebook page, so they should both be easy to find. So thank you all again very much for tuning in for this episode. As I said, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed researching it and presenting it. And I hope you'll tune in for the next one. And on that note, really sorry again for the long delay in getting this episode posted. I can't promise that it will never happen again, but yeah, I will certainly try henceforward to keep as much on schedule as I can and to try not to have long delays like that again. So, having said that, I hope you will all tune back in for the next episode, which hopefully will occur more or less on schedule this time, and in which I will be talking about the Masquerade and the Red Death. So hopefully that will be fun and interesting for all of you. And in the meantime, happy Halloween, or Samhain, or Day of the Dead, or whatever version of the holiday you celebrate if you celebrate it, and have a fun, safe, and phantom-filled time until next time. Disclaimer: the opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters and do not reflect the views of the host, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Cameron McIntosh, the Really Useful Group, or any other person or entity. In addition, this podcast is not in any way affiliated with Andrew Lloyd Webber, the Really Useful Group, Cameron McIntosh, or with any other person or entity involved in the production of any version of Phantom.